Welcome to Real Talk, Real Estate Discussions with Andrew Kirsch. In each episode, Andrew interviews industry leaders. We'll hear their real-time opinions on today's market, their background and unique career highlights, and guidance for newcomers into the industry. You can find this show at skalarkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. Now here's the host of Real Talk, Andrew Kirsch.
Episode 46 of Real Talk. I want to start by thanking my client, Carol Wood, Adam Tischer, Adam Rubin, Andrew Shanfield, Daniel Abrams, for including me on your closing trip to Aspen for the purchase of the Aon Center. We had the Adams on, Tischer and Rubin, a couple weeks ago talking about that acquisition. They included me along with several tenant rep brokers, office brokers, to a memorable trip to Aspen as they're kicking off leasing activity at that building. So thank you guys. It was a fantastic couple days. This week on Real Talk, I have Chris Berg from Abernathy Holding Companies. Chris, former college football player at Stanford, told some great stories of the Bill Walsh and Denny Green days. Was in media, was a journalist who interviewed presidents and cabinet members throughout his career, then made a pivot to real estate, where he's focusing on the development and acquisition of self-storage properties. He leads the California expansion of Abernathy. Self-storage is one of the, I would like to say, select or unique asset classes, specialty asset classes that a lot of our capital clients are interested in investing more dollars in. So I think you'll enjoy my conversation with Chris Berg. And finally, it's March Madness. Shout out to my Northwestern Wildcats for making the tournament for the second time in a row, third time in history. It will be the first time I don't go to an NCAA tournament game of Northwestern's as they're playing in Brooklyn. And so I wish you all the best, Northwestern. I don't have you winning the bracket, but I do have you advancing to the second round. Go Cats.
Welcome to another edition of Real Talk. I'm here with Chris Berg of Abernathy Holdings. Chris, how are you today?
You know what? I didn't realize I was moving back to Seattle, my friend. So other than that, I'm doing well. I mean, the rain that's been going on here has been, what is happening in Southern California right now?
Don't talk to me about this. I'm in the middle of building a house and we're digging a basement and it literally is the worst time to build a basement in a house in LA.
It's been stunning to watch it. You know, I'm talking to my friends back in North Dakota and I'm like, yeah, it's 45, 50 degrees right now, which it's never like that in you know, January, February. So I'm like, yeah, it's definitely different than sunny SoCal.
You know, we pay, what do we pay? 12-13% state income taxes and to have good weather. So if we're not going to have good weather, there could be a revolt. There already is a revolt, I guess, of people moving out of California. And there could be even a greater revolt if this weather doesn't pick up because, you know, Newsom should be able to control the weather.
Cloud seeding's coming, I assume.
Yeah. So, Chris, you were generous enough to have me on your podcast and sort of like engulf in a home and home when one person invites someone to their course and you reciprocate. So I wanted to thank you for coming on to Real Talk and thank you for having me onto your show.
Thank you. I mean, I loved our conversation. It was like playing tennis with a pro. He was just bap, 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 and a great conversation about the ULA and what's happening in San Francisco and LA and things like that. So it was just, I thought it was a lot of value for people.
Well, I appreciate that. Now you made a sports analogy. I always make sports analogies. Tennis wasn't my sport. My sport was baseball. I played college baseball, but you played college football at Stanford under Bill Walsh and Dennis Green. Tell my audience, because they're sick of me talking about college baseball. Come on, that's nothing. Playing Pac-10 football, Stanford. What was that like?
It was fantastic. And I'll share with you just one quick story that a lot of people appreciate. We went into Notre Dame one year and I was fortunate to play with John Lynch, who's the GM now of the 49ers and a Hall of Famer. And if you don't know John's story, it's incredible because he was really a quarterback, which is what I played. And then he was just going to go play baseball professionally. And Bill Walsh actually talked him to coming back on to play free safety for us. And Bill Walsh, obviously a pretty good ability to pick talent. Now, you know, John being in the Hall of Fame. But I remember we were in Notre Dame. We were down 16-0. And do you remember Jerome Bettis, the bus?
Of course.
So Jerome Bettis is coming around the end. And he, you know, they were beating us pretty good at this point. And all of a sudden, here comes little John Lynch. He just, boom, just lights up Bettis. And he fumbles. We recover. We end up driving down to score, winning that game. And it was just a huge, huge victory. And I think Bill Walsh even said one of his greatest victories of his career, you know, winning at Golden Dome, the home of the Golden Domers after that start. So it was a pretty special moment, you know.
Wow. And so was this after Bill Walsh won the Super Bowls with the Niners?
Yeah. And he came back for a second tenure. I was actually recruited by Dennis Green, which I loved. I mean, he was a fantastic coach. And then he ended up going to the Minnesota Vikings. So then Bill Walsh came back for a second tenure.
Amazing. So my favorite Dennis Green story. I'm sure, I don't know if you know, he was the head football coach at Northwestern, and his tenure at Northwestern started, or I should say what preceded his tenure, I think was four consecutive years of Northwestern not winning a football game. I think they had 45 games in a row that they lost. He then goes 3-8 and he won Big Ten Coach of the Year because it was that difficult and that much of an accomplishment that Northwestern won three games. He literally wins Big Ten Coach of the Year, winning three games.
But you know what? That is him. Like one quick anecdote, and I will get into real estate. But so very first year there, we had a Johnny Unitas finalist by the name of Jason Columbus. Had a great career at Stanford, but he hurt his shoulder going into his senior season. So we get through the first, you know, two and a half, three games, and we had a redshirt freshman by the name of Steve Stensrum. And Dennis Green actually said, "Hey, Stenny, get in the game. We're going to pull Jason for a little bit," which Johnny Unitas finalist, you just don't do that, right? But Coach Green was like, "Look, we're just not performing well right now. We got to go out and win football games." And that was one of the things that everybody, and it sounds like you too, just respected about Dennis Green. He was like, "Whatever we got to do to win, that's what we're going to do."
Yeah, I love that. And look, there's so much we could talk about sports and how it translates to the professional world and real estate. And even in my law firm, you know, if you played college sports, there is a certain attention to detail, time management, getting the job done, being a team player, all of that. That translates into the working world. So let's talk about the working world and let's talk about Abernathy. For my audience who may not know Abernathy Holdings, what is it? What sector do you concentrate in?
So we really focus on Class A self-storage in California and Arizona. And we've been very fortunate. Many of us within Abernathy Holdings are actually born and raised in North Dakota. And so Andrew Abernathy, obviously this Abernathy Holdings, young guy, grew up on a farm, made a bunch of money in real estate before he was even 18, and ended up raising probably around $50 to $80 million for our fund. But then what's great is the town is so small, it's like 200 people, but our JV partner is from this little tiny town in North Dakota. He ended up being the biggest private hotel developer in the country at one point. I mean, Andrew, you know real estate really, really well. One year, he did 54 hotels in one year. I mean, he was just knocking them out. Ended up selling a portfolio to Goldman for like $1.3 billion. Had a $900 million 1031 exchange he had to pull off, which is in his book, and it's a fascinating story. But, you know, he continued to do some hotels, and then he got into self-storage. He was like, wow, these are some pretty amazing returns happening here. He and I became friends as we talked about our sports. He was really into sports and wanted to play professional baseball. Yeah. Wasn't talented enough, so he was playing, you know, major softball stuff. And he and I just became good buddies because of our athletic acumen back home. I would take him out for lunch and breakfast and whatnot to have him mentor me. And so he said, "Hey, look, we're looking for a guy to do land acquisition in California. You know, what do you think?" And it was something I was looking to get out of the media, get into more finance and real estate. So it was just a great open door, and he's a really, really fantastic mentor.
That's great. Self-storage is one of these asset classes specialty asset class, I'd like to call it, where a lot of our capital clients are interested in allocating more dollars to self-storage and other niche product types, going away from office, maybe going away temporarily, probably from multifamily. And you know, retail has had a resurgence, but for many years has had many headwinds. So talk about you know, self-storage. And today, do you find yourself where more capital today is interested in pursuing self-storage deals than previously?
100%. I mean, there is a lot of capital right now in this space. As I'm going around and looking for land and talking to different brokers and whatnot, you know, there's some sovereign wealth funds that are involved, or they can just scratch a check, right? And so not everybody's able to do that, but I think you're seeing so much capital move into the space. One, obviously, is the returns. And secondly, I think it's one of the few asset classes where the laws, as you know, are really in favor of the landlord, right? Like if a person doesn't pay within 30 days, you can put a lock on their door. They continue not to pay, you can sell the stuff and re-rent it, where you know these laws better than I do, especially in Southern California. And yet, if you go out and do multifamily in Southern California and someone doesn't pay, there's a lot more challenges than 30 days.
Oh, for sure. And so is Abernathy, are you buying existing, or are you exclusively a developer of self-storage?
Great question. So right now we're strictly doing development. So class A development, we go out and we buy the land, bring it through entitlements, get it up and running. And then we've got a third party manager. So Public Storage is our third party manager, which is fantastic, right? I mean, they charge, this is sort of what Gary, our JV partner, did. I forgot to mention his name, Gary Tharaldson. But so when he was building hotels, he would build, you know, Marriott and things of that nature and then pay them the management fee. So it's a really good structure that he knows. It works really well because Public Storage charges a very, very fair management fee, in our opinion. So we go out and build those, and then they go ahead and manage them. And then we're looking to just build a nice portfolio, probably of 100 sites over, you know, with rates up, maybe things are moving as quickly as we anticipated, but let's say 10 to 15 years, and Public Storage probably steps in and buys the portfolio at one point. Although I think with where things are at right now with rates, and you see a lot of the refinancing conversation taking place, that no doubt if we found some opportunities out there where there's some distressed assets and guys couldn't refi, and we can step in and acquire some properties that are already built and it makes sense for us from a IRR perspective, I mean, we absolutely would be open to that.
So what do you look for as, you know, ideal land candidates for a self-storage project?
So for us with Class A self-storage, we're looking at a few different metrics. One is population within a 3-mile radius, ideally is 80,000. We're looking for an 80,000 minimum household income within that 3-mile radius. We'd like to see a certain number of vehicles per day, you know, driving by if we can. But then there's some really powerful pieces of software out there right now, Andrew, where you can go and look at where rates are currently at, which we'll touch upon that in a moment, what's going on in the rate world right now. But obviously, of course, supply too. I mean, Sam Zell always tells that great story about when he walked into his first econ class at University of Michigan and says, supply and demand. He's like, I never forgot that. And that's the bottom line with real estate. So, you know, if you're fortunate enough to find some places where there's a low supply and decent rates and you can get the dirt for a decent price, more times than not, you're probably going to have a pretty valuable asset in the long run.
And what's the average size, I guess, in unit count of your locations?
So we're building minimum 100,000 gross square feet. So you're talking, you know, 650, 800 units, depending on how and big we end up doing it. I think we've got one in Moreno Valley that's going to be about 130,000, if I'm not mistaken. Another one in Fresno is going to be roughly that same number. So obviously, the bigger we can go, the more economies of scale, and yet we do a minimum of 100,000.
So, you know, we represent clients who are in self-storage development like yourself. And recently, over the last couple of years, certainly coming out of COVID, it seems that more and more municipalities are preventing self-storage development. You know, one of the reasons that I've been getting both from my clients and from city officials is that self-storage facilities don't produce the jobs that other industrial or commercial uses produce. So how have you seen that, I guess, number one, and how are you able to navigate this new trend where cities may, if this is your perception, of cities not wanting self-storage?
Such a great question. I hope you will clip this clip and send it to a bunch of municipalities across the state, because here's what we're working on right now within the California Self-Storage Association, is to begin to reframe the leaders within these cities and help them understand, like, one of the really powerful things about self-storage right now, like, yes, it may not have a lot of employment numbers, and yet when you look at what's happening with so many, 1099 type of businesses, small businesses out there, self-storage is an incredible small business incubator, right? For these guys that are just getting started, maybe they've got stock of different products or whatnot, but they don't have a lot right now because it's a fairly new business. We want to help these municipalities understand, like, look, these are great small business incubators. And as these business grow, then they make it more of an industrial site, or, you know, buy some more office space or whatever their business plan has them doing. But initially, especially with all these Amazon shippers and whatnot, we see it as a great opportunity to be a support for small business owners, especially with all the multifamily stuff happening too within the state. You know, if you're going to go develop multifamily, you don't want a bunch of stuff strewn all over the patios or in the driveways. And so that's another way that we're trying to reframe some of these cities to say, look, we're going to help these multifamily people, you know, put stuff where it needs to be, keep things looking clean, and help make your community look great.
And what's their reaction?
It's a new reframe that we're working on right now. We haven't had a lot of opportunity to do any market testing on it. But as we're having internal conversations, that's our pitch at this point.
Yeah. Now, are you seeing this sentiment in specific areas of the state? Is it all of California? Is it just Southern California? And are they seeing it throughout, you know, other states that Abernathy transacts in?
You know, it is all over the place. There's no doubt about it. I think there's other municipalities that are more against it than others. You know, for example, we're up in Fresno, Clovis, and they've been fantastic, very open arms. They get it. They've got a lot of people moving in from the Bay Area, so they're great with it. Right now, if you head over to like Palm Springs or some of those communities within that area, they said, hey, we feel like we've got enough of self-storage right now. And if you look at it from a supply perspective, per capita, you know, they may be correct in that assessment, yet the rates in that area continue to stay pretty high because you've obviously got people that are moving in and out, coming in for vacation. So I think some municipalities may have a fair argument around it, but it's not a forever moratorium, I don't think. I think some of these places are like, look, let's just put it on hold for a little while, then we can revisit this.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're buying raw land or land that has other uses that you're going to convert into self-storage. How long typically is the entitlement process before you can pull a building permit and start getting shovels in the ground?
It's a great question. Again, every municipality is a little bit different, but to give you an example, we put our Fresno site under contract last May, I believe. We'll close middle end of March and then have shovels in the ground. We're hoping end of Q3, early Q4.
Mm-hmm. And then how are you structuring your deals? You know, a lot of our clients, when they're acquiring land and they understand there can be a protracted entitlement process, they would typically put the land under an option agreement and secure the land that way. And then ultimately, once they get through land use entitlements, then acquire the land. And so during the entitlement process, perhaps delivering the seller some non-refundable option payments after a due diligence period. That way they're not capital constrained by sitting on land that they own and going through an entitlement process.
Yeah, very similar. You know, again, each seller's been a little bit different. Some have wanted somebody to go hard after due diligence. The number varies with each seller. But we definitely are not going to close until we know for certain that, hey, we can get the entitlements to go out and build what we want to build, which is a minimum of 100,000 gross square foot self-storage site.
Yeah. So I want to pivot the conversation. You know, a lot of my clients who have been in the real estate business, you know, they go to college or grad school and get a master's degree, perhaps in real estate, or they've been working in real estate straight out of college. But you have taken a different path. Tell my audience, what were you doing both previous to working at Abernathy?
Really good question. So I was in media for about 12 to 13 years, had an incredible experience there, where had an opportunity to interview the President of the United States 3 times, Secretary of State, dignitaries. So, you know, it was a really, really great experience. The unfortunate part is I'm a big believer in you reap what you sow. And that industry's business model is, hey, go out and sow anger and fear and get paid more. And I just finally got to a point where I just couldn't get in front of the mic easily every day anymore. It was like this, I don't want to sow this fear and anger anymore. It's a lot of it's not true. And then now that I've taken a step out of that industry, it's incredible, because as I'm around people that are still sort of inoculated in certain media, let's say, you know, whether it be Fox News or whatever it might be, that you're with these people. And I've definitely stepped back and checked out. And it's incredible, because they're like, oh my gosh, the sky is falling. Did you see this? Did you see that? And I grab my phone and I'm like, this was over the holidays recently. I'm like, wow, that's fascinating. Cause like the Dow just hit a near all-time high. So did the NASDAQ. Yeah. Like, so it's like, things can't be all that bad. So I share all that because I recently did an interview with a buddy of mine back home, because I said, hey, if there's one message I could give people today, and I would say the same thing to your audience, depending on how much they're immersed in the news. But if you can do your, like, probably one of the greatest mental health things I've done for myself was remove myself from that industry. And so what I would share with people is that if there's one thing you could do right now, especially in an election year, and don't be ignorant, I'm not suggesting that, and turn off your TV and talk radio. Like, what it will do for your mental health will be incredible.
Wow. And so who did you work for? What media platforms were you part of?
So I was with called Gray Television. So they own television stations all over the country. And I was fortunate. I was doing a morning show, like a Today show. And then I did a show in the evening that was really issue political oriented. And that's why I was, you know, doing a lot of interviews with either the President of the United States or Secretary of State or U.S. senators and whatnot. So again, I loved it. You know, I don't know how much you've done politically, but boy, next to football, I don't know if there's a better, you know, game than politics, right? I mean, the strategy, the gaming. So I loved it. And it just was, I'll give you a really good story, Andrew. When I first got into this, meaning real estate, and moved back out to California, it was very close to the time frame when that shooting took place in Nashville at the school. Do you remember that story?
Sure.
And I don't say this to be callous. It's just an honest response. And I remember when I heard the news, my first reaction was, oh, thank goodness I don't need to go spend 2 hours of my life researching someone that's having mental health issues when we still haven't solved this problem, right? And when I had that reaction, I was like, wow, okay, it's clear I've made the right decision to remove myself. Because again, I don't say that to be callous. It was just a very interesting response, even for myself, to realize like how grateful I was not to have to go spend time dealing with something that is, you know, when you're in that industry, every 9 to 12 months, there's another mass shooting. And it's like, okay, are we going to solve this? Or are we just going to sit around and continue to have this happen?
What lessons or what have you been able to take from your time in media and politics into real estate?
You know, I didn't realize how political real estate is, right?
Especially you're doing land development. So that's very political.
Exactly. And I had a great interview with Ben Resnick, a very powerful attorney here in California around land use and entitlements. And so he went right there too. I didn't realize his political background or how he was sort of involved with that. And so that's been interesting to see how you really want to be able to, you know, dance between some of the raindrops, if you will, when it comes to some of the planning commissions and city leaders and whatnot. So that's been really fascinating. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's all about relationships. I think that's one of the things that I really appreciate about real estate that maybe I didn't know, is just how relationship based it is, and hard work. I mean, that's like anything, you know, that as well as a student athlete.
Sure. Well, look, if, you know, real estate is hyper political, especially in these days, whether it's affordable housing, homeless issues, I think even the office sector is going to become highly political, that you are going to have these giant skyscrapers vacant and what to do with them. And so, the intertwine between politics, local politics, and real estate has always been there. And it's frustrating, at least for my client base, who's in multifamily, they feel that they're the ones under attack when they're trying to provide housing, and it's supply and demand. And a lot of my clients feel that if the local governments just allow the developers to develop more housing, it will just solve this issue. But yet it is so difficult to develop in this state, as you know, who's developing self-storage. So I don't know, any thoughts that you may have of the intersection between politics and real estate, and how we just seem to be running up against a brick wall and trying to solve at least this one issue of housing.
Yeah, you know, I don't understand why they make it so difficult from a housing and multifamily perspective. And that's something I'm trying to better understand. And yet from an asset perspective, I will share that when I was first coming back out to California and sharing that with people, they literally would laugh at me and go, man, what are you thinking? That state is nutso. And they would keep going on and on and on, right? And yet our JV billionaire hotel developer would say, that's exactly why we want to go there, right? It's a very high level to get to be able to build in there. So when you do find something and you're able to build it, I mean, it is a tremendously valuable asset. So there's obviously those two different perspectives. And the thing that I think is sort of sad is as I drive around the state, you know, I love this state. It's beautiful. I mean, the resources here, from energy to agriculture to obviously the coast and the weather. I mean, it's just, it's stunning the amount of resources here. So when I see us sort of tripping over ourselves to try to solve a problem that I think is definitely solvable, because so many people are leaving because they just can't afford to live here anymore. And it's just a sad thing to see. And it what's sad is, it like when I talk to people, Andrew, coming from North Dakota, again, a very pro-liberty state, if you will, is I've had people tell me where they feel like the state literally squeezed them out of here. Like it feels very, the words they use, it feels very punitive. It feels like a weight on my back. I got pushed out of the state. And that's their language, not mine. And it's just sad to hear that because I think it's such an amazing place.
Sure. I mean, at least 2/3 of our transactions these days are outside of California. And whether it's Sunbelt or, you know, all the way down to the Southeast, they still choose to live here because usually, except today, the weather is really nice, but they just cannot stand doing business here. And then the other third uses the same, has the same mindset that you mentioned, that they like to transact here because it's so tough and they have the stomach and the wherewithal to go through a 5-year or longer entitlement process of a challenging site, because they know that once they get it entitled, it's gold, and that there is a lack of supply, unlike some of these other places where you can just build forever. I'm not saying one is right or one is wrong. It's just different ways to make money in and make a livelihood in this business.
Yeah, I agree. And I think one of the things that's going to be interesting, as you mentioned, is what's going to happen with office. You know, my gut and my thesis is that the government will step in at some point and try to help with some conversions there. Now, whether that works or not, time will tell. But also you got to look at tech, right? Like how is tech going to start to impact real estate to bring down, whether that be cost of construction, or the ability to maybe, you know, you see these 3D homes now that are being created. Is that going to sort of shift some of the dynamics? And I think when it comes to construction costs, as I'm talking to GCs, I don't know how much you're in the construction world, but, you know, GCs are like, yeah, we kind of thought construction costs were going to start coming down because rates were going up. But I think what a lot of people are forgetting, Andrew, is you've got $750 billion of COVID money that states are sitting on, which needs to be appropriated by the end of this year and then spent in 25, which is going to be a lot of roads and bridges and et cetera. And then you got $1 trillion from the infrastructure bill. I mean, that is a lot of liquidity sitting around. And so I think you would anticipate, especially when you see, if you watch now, a lot of private companies are starting to have layoffs. I mean, Nike did 2% last week and Toast did 500 employees. But yet the construction business is not happening because there's all this public money out there that's keeping the construction people afloat right now.
It's interesting times. I mean, we're seeing a lack of transactional volume for the last 18 months, close to now 24 months. Yet stock markets seemingly every day is a all-time high. Inflation numbers aren't really coming down. I mean, they've come down from, you know, 7-8% of a year ago, but higher than what economists thought. Economists for sure thought we were going to be in a recession. Have we been one? Have we not been in one? The labor market is tight as ever, yet major companies are reducing. So where are they going? How are we still having 3% unemployment? It's really a mind-boggling confluence of factors here. I don't know what to make of it. And then, of course, put a hotly contested, highly anticipated presidential election, and maybe people just sit in the sideline on the sidelines until November. I really don't know what to make about this coming year.
Well, I think it's going to be interesting. And it's one of those things that's why I say don't be ignorant. And yet, can you trust the headlines right now? What's going to be coming out as far as CPI and employment numbers? And, you know, if you go back and you look at some of the revisions from the Labor Bureau statistics, I mean, they're much different than that, you know, highlight number that comes out on a Friday or whatever the day is that they come out. So I think that's one of those things that the general public, who's going to go back and look at the revisions, right? Nobody is, unless that's your world. Right. So I think you've got to pay attention to that. But also, you know, many people I feel kind of get a gut as they talk to neighbors. You know, what's the old saying? When your neighbor's unemployed, it's a recession. But when you're unemployed, it's a depression. Yeah. So we'll see how that sort of bears out. But as you mentioned, the numbers are staying pretty decent. And yet with all the public money that's in there for at least the construction aspect of stuff and infrastructure, it may not be as pervasive, especially in that blue collar arena, as people think.
Yeah. All right. Final question for you. I want to be respectful of your time. You know, so many people are, they seem, I guess, nervous or skeptical of even within real estate to change product types. Maybe they've been in office and they know that office isn't in vogue anymore and they want to switch product types. Or they haven't been in real estate and they've been doing something else and they want to get into real estate, but they feel like, well, they're tagged as, you know, being a lawyer or being in media or being in finance. And you have been able to successfully pivot industries. And so many folks feel like if they don't know what they want to do by the time they graduate college and that's the industry that they're going to be in for the next 50, 60 years, they're screwed if they don't pick the right industry. So if you could just tell my audience, especially those that are perhaps you know, having that quandary of should I switch careers? Should I switch product types? Will people take me seriously? How do I do that? Because you've done it successfully. And so any tips that you can provide my audience would be great.
I mean, I think you just got to go with what feels right in your heart, right? I mean, there's more to my story where I had gone through a divorce. My ex-wife had moved back out here with our daughter. So there was a lot of variables that, because if you would have came to me 18 months ago, Andrew, and said, hey, Chris, you know, I got a feeling you're going to be moving back to California, I would have thought, there's no way that's going to happen, right? And yet, here I am. And it was a great opportunity that opened up for me. It's something that I was praying about, that I really wanted to become a part of, was real estate and finance. And it's like my second half. You know, is it how I would have drafted it up when I was 15? Probably not. I mean, I say to everybody right now, because I really love this industry. I wish you or somebody would have came to me 25 years ago and just kind of, you know, grabbed me by the arm and said, hey, all this stuff you want to do is great. Just go do real estate. It's a great industry, great business. But I didn't know. I didn't have anybody in my family or around me that, which is kind of ironic growing up in North Dakota where you're surrounded by land, but nobody that really talked to me about real estate. And so it's one of those things where as I started to do my own learning and homework, I was like, wow, it's a great industry. It's not perfect. Nothing is, but I love it. I think it's fantastic.
No, it's great. Well, for me, I wanted to be in entertainment. So that's why I have my podcast, so I could feel like I'm important and have my own show and, you know, walk around the streets and sign autographs. Chris, it's an honor and a privilege for you coming on. I know you're busy. So thank you so much for coming on to Real Talk.
Thank you, man. And I got to say, and I'm not saying this just to say this, like, you do a really, really outstanding job. I mean, I know you're an attorney. And so I don't know how many times you've been in a courtroom or juries and asking questions, but I've seen a lot of podcasts and you do a really, really good job. So thank you for having me on.
No, oh, I appreciate it. Chris, good luck and stay dry. Take care.
Thanks, man.
You've been listening to Real Talk, Real Estate Discussions with Andrew Kirsch. You can catch prior episodes at scholarkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. Thank you for your positive reviews, comments, and for sharing the show with others.